Okay, good morning. Welcome back. It's a pretty day here in eastern Taiwan. Thursday, September 23rd, 2021. At least that's what they tell us. Class 16, Life and Teachings of Nisargadatta Maharaj. We're going through the page innerquest.org. Where there's a biography, I didn't realize how good it is. A biography of Nisargadatta from G.K. Damodaro Rao, who's also Maharashtrian, which is the province or the state of India wherein is Bombay. They are Marathi speakers, the language of that area, Marathi. Nityananda also spoke Marathi. That it's very interesting, there's a lot of very deep spirituality coming from, I mean, a certain Vedanta heartland, it seemed, from Bombay down through Kerala and Tiruvannamalai in the south, further south, home or zone of Ramana Maharshi. And so there was some pretty heavy hitters and some very important Advaita Vedanta Yanis in that zone of mid and southern east western India. It's basically western coast of India in the middle and down to the south. Last time we did a portion of the multiple sections of the biography from Mr. Rao, and continuing, I'm just going to just move right along with it. It's very nice to get this biography of Nisargadatta and see the formative influences personally. That's the way it goes. That's why I'm thinking that the view from the summit of the mountain is the same for one and all. It's the same view, but the paths up the mountain are countless and unique. And each being that appears to have traversed the path of soul evolution in apparently real time and space gets to the summit of the mountain or gets to awakening or gets beyond the octave in their own unique way. And whether they're in sixth density, as a yani, or they're in eighth density, at one with Parabrahman, Paramatman, there's unique perspective. And so I have mine and you have yours, and we're still on the path, and we're seeing the formative ingredients to Nisargadatta through this biography. And all these great teachers such as he were all great seekers. Every great teacher was a great seeker, or may still be, but seek and you shall find. The great, the Ra said something like, the strength of the inner light, I forgot the exact quote, but the strength of the inner light is equivalent to the strength of the will to seek the inner light. The inner light means complete and total enlightenment, freedom. Complete freedom, perfection. Seven chakra, seven dimensional perfection. And that's, the summit of the mountain. The finishing this all of this octave. And the strength of one's light is totally dependent upon, or really is the same as the will to seek that light. The will to freedom. Because we're talking about not just some light in your head or light in your eyes, it's radical freedom. And the end of all becoming, the end of ignorance and craving, for sure. The end of rebirth, the work fully completed, which is the work of the octave, and that first stop is higher self, and next stop is eighth density, seems to me, and that correlates perfectly to me with Nisargadatta talking about the first stage of awakening. One becomes a yani, and I think that's sixth density, Atman, Jivatman. And then the yani must realize his, her own death, realize his own death, well, there's nothing. if it can die, it ain't real. Or if it can die, it's impermanent, born of light, illusory, insubstantial. Okay, so that's going to eight. And that, in Buddhism, looks to me like non-returner in sixth density, like Hindu or Vedantic Atman or Ra material, Ra in late sixth density. And then the final is becoming one with Logos, eighth density, becoming guardian, one with Paramatman, or complete and perfect enlightenment, the deathless in Buddhism, Nibbana, extinguishing the flame that's born of ignorance and craving and manifests in light, in the octave. The end of that's the end of the work in this all. Then we have the work in the next octave. So, Nisargadatta explains that process really well. And so let's look further. So this next section is called Some Less Known Facts in Maharaj's Life. Maharaj as Great King, their honorific title for Nisargadatta. I prefer to call these guys by that other name, like Gautama or Nisargadatta and Nityananda. The honorifics are great, but I feel great respect for them already. That's why I'm spending countless hours on each of them. So I respect them enough, I think. So, some less known facts in Maharaj's life begins from Damodara Rao. I have collected them, these less known facts, from the sheaf of papers sent by Dr. Rashinkar. Rashinkar was a colleague, I guess. In the early childhood, Maruti, which is another name for Nisargadatta, Maruti had very little formal education, and one is amazed at the way he blossomed in later life into a great jnani. Maharaj ascribed it to the grace of Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj, meaning his teacher, his guru, Siddha Rameshwar. As for his early childhood, he used to go to the farm with his father and work in the fields. He was a very healthy young boy and was of great use to his father in plowing the land, preparing the seed bed, etc. Deep down, his father was full of remorse that his son was not attending school. The conflict was between sending him to a primary school in Kandalgaon, where the education was only up to fourth grade, and the future well-being of the family, which primarily depended on agriculture, meaning farming. In those days, even for going to a school in a village in the rural areas, the children had to walk 5 or 6 miles on foot daily and return late in the evening, giving an anxious time for the parents who will be awaiting their return. Right, there's danger in that too. The age of Maruti, his being a young child, was also not suitable for this kind of daily ordeal. Yet his father, having lived in Bombay, knew the value of higher education, but the circumstances were against sending him to a school in an urban area. So he couldn't go to a school in Bombay, and there was a real conflict about him going to school even nearby his village because the family needed help in the fields. As such, daily routine of Maruti was to go with his father and his brothers, work in the farm, take the cattle for grazing in the nearby forest. In the evenings, regularly the father used to gather the family and tell them stories from Navnat Bhaktisar, Ram Vijay, and Bhakti Vivay. These are, religious writers or documents, stories in the Maharashtra religious community. Sometimes Vishnu Gore, it's funny, Gore, am I right? Al Gore. Gore is a name of, is a family name in Maharashtra, it seems. Sometimes Vishnu Gore, the erudite Brahmin priest, will join them, and both he and Maruti's father used to discuss adhyatma is oneself. Vishnu Gore was also an astrologer, and Maruti in his formative years, meaning Nisargadatta, had great admiration for him. He was an example of piety, courage, perseverance, and hard work. Though the brothers of Maruti had already seen life in Bombay, Maruti was out and out a product of a completely rural life. But yet a spirit of inquiry got possession of him even at the early age of 14 years and aroused his inquisitiveness. He used to think as follows, quote, "We sow very little in the fields, but we get back much more in quantity for a little effort of sowing when there was nothing but soil and water in the field. How was that possible? From where came the fruit? And how did the sour ones ripen automatically into sweet ones? All fruit have seeds inside, except in the case of the cashew nut, in which the seed was protruding from the fruit." I don't know if he really thought that, but okay. These questions disturbed Maruti's mind, and he could not get satisfactory answers. He put a question to his father about this, and he said that it was the Leela of God, the play of God. He then thought that God must be a very powerful person, as everything depended on him. He heard stories from Navnat Bhaktisar that they could do and undo things if they willed it, meaning the great yogis could. It therefore troubled his mind how they could do and undo things if all the creation was looked after by God. In his innocent way, he thought that Navnat is a kind of like a saint or a yogi. It's a term for a type of Navnat. In his innocent way, he thought that these Navnats were more powerful than God. Then the question arose in his mind, is there one God or many gods? He could not get a satisfactory answer. It was then that he met his Satguru, Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj, who explained to him in a convincing way that God manages everything, birth, death, etc., and was more powerful than the Navnats, especially Machindranat. Machindranat, these are all what sect of Vedanta or Hindu tradition they're coming out of, these Navnats, I'm not sure. Machindranat, Matsyendranat, they're different spellings of the same saint. So this, what's spelled here is M-A-T-C-H, Machindranat, not any T-H at the end. Machindra may otherwise be spelled as Matsyenda, Matsyendra. I've seen that spelling. It may be the same great knot of that tradition. So, going on, Maruti was a healthy boy and used to do his best to help the needy persons on the occasion of funerals, firefighting, and so on. Being very healthy and strong, on many occasions he helped the villagers to lift their cattle, which had fallen into a well while grazing. He had no distinction of caste and creed and felt very much for the poor families of the Harijans, lower caste. He used to question his father, quote, I don't know how he got these quotes, but, if there is a merciful God, why should poverty be there? And why should some people be born in a high family and others in a low family? His father, Shivaram Pant, was inwardly happy, or though inwardly happy about the intelligent questions put by his son Maruti, was yet apprehensive that he had not given Maruti a decent education to survive in the battle of life. Maruti's father died in 1915, and a few hours before his death, he told Vishnu Gaur that he would be shedding his body that day, so his father knew. Maruti loved his father very intensely, and his father died with his head on the lap of young Maruti, who was plunged in sorrow. This is sort of a hagiography, a little bit. Thus, Maruti, with his intuitive intelligence, though his formal education was low, had the help of his father's friend Vishnu Gur, who molded in him a right frame of mind in his search for God. The unpolluted rural life in the village helped Maruti pursue the questions with the help of his father's friend. It has to be remembered that Maruti was a Bhandari by caste. This is a caste, subcaste, I guess, in Maharashtra, who were traditionally engaged in production and sale of country liquor, toddy, and so on. But Shivaram Pant, I think that's the father, had kept them away from this traditional business as he did not like his sons to continue in it. So the father was of the caste of merchants that traditionally sold liquor. That may be why Nisargadatta ended up being a smoker and going into running a beedi shop or shops. That kind of thing early influence remains, and it does not not an impediment, you know, to awakening. Actually, it was in 1918, in his early 20s, that Maruti decided to go to Bombay to work to support his family. In Bombay, he used to work in the daytime and study in the night, which was very taxing, especially for young Maruti. Taxing especially for him. It's taxing for anybody. He found that it was not possible to go to the school regularly, but the family needed money. So he sought work as a clerk at the Princess Dock in Bombay's harbor, thus ending his education forever, formal education. However, his mind was restless, and as a young man, he thought of the future and wanted to increase his income for the benefit of the family. He was ambitious and therefore decided to do some business on his own instead of serving others. And that was meaning working for others. So you can see he was a hardworking, from a hardworking family that had to work hard for anything they had. Nothing was really given. And this merchant is the third caste, right? You've got Brahmin, warrior, merchant, trader, and then untouchable, so-called lowest caste. And he was a solid, seriously responsible person from day one in the family and community. Next section, becomes Maruti Rao Shet. Though Maruti did not have any formal education, he was intelligent and physically strong. As he had a family to maintain, he had a necessity to think of other avenues that would get him substantial income to maintain the family in reasonable comfort. After great deliberation, he decided to start some business of his own instead of working under masters. He collected some capital and started a small shop selling bidis, pan, tobacco, etc. So the bidi is a hand-rolled certain kind of leaf with tobacco mainly that is ubiquitous throughout India. I used to smoke bidis when I was in high school from the very strange Indian antiques and curios shop in the East Village of Manhattan in the late 70s. And the bidis are really small and funky, and they got weirder as the decades went on. Pan is a certain kind of, I don't know what it is. I'm not sure if it's a bean or something, or a lentil. Anyway, it's very popular also. This is sort of cheap food. So he opened a shop because he was hardworking and ambitious, and he's very intelligent, you know, so he was smarter than most of the people around him, I imagine. After it became popular, he realized the limitations of this shop in the matter of expansion. With the money he saved, he decided to enter other lines of business. He started a cutlery shop, and when it got him a sizable income, he started another shop, selling ready-made garments. He was by nature very economical, and when profits came, he did not squander them away. Then he started production of a different kind of bidis, as the bidi business was very lucrative. His bidis in particular acquired a high reputation and were in great demand. Then he started a cloth shop. When he started earning sufficiently, he got married to one Sumathibai in 1924, so his late 20s. He often used to say that God was kind and merciful to him. He always wanted what really belonged to him. He used to ask his guru, quote, "Kindly tell me who I am and what is mine. I want what is mine. I will not touch anything that is not mine." When he pressed his guru for an answer to who he was, his guru told him that he was the ultimate truth. His business was very prosperous, and he employed as many as 40 assistants to look after his shops, which were located in different places in Bombay, from Ketwadi in Girgaum, a district of Bombay, to Buribundur, depends on how, I don't know the accents. People finding him very prosperous used to address him as Shet, which is an appellation for moneyed people who had become prosperous in business. They now used to address him as Maruti Rao Shet, S-H-E-T, Shet. He thus achieved a great deal of success in his material life, but this could not solve the basic questions in his mind which had remained unanswered since his boyhood days. He often used to think on questions as, what is this world, who am I, where is God, can we see him or talk to him? Day after day, these questions agitated him, and slowly he was losing interest in his business. He met so many sadhus and sannyasis who were only in appearance saffron-clad sadhus, wearing a number of malas, beaded necklaces. A mala is a bead necklace, a beaded necklace or a necklace of beads, and prominently displaying tilaks, but they were ignorant about God. In India, you got a lot of sadhus all over the page. Some of them are black magicians. Some of them are just looking to scam people. Some of them are super sincere and devout and holy and pure and super disciplined. Some of them are just older fellows or people who've gotten to an age and they didn't make any great attainment and they're like homeless and have a hard time living. And they're not beggars exactly, but they just have. We saw this guy in India in near the Ganges in Varanasi. There was like a home for aged sadhus or aged sannyasis, and many of the guys in there looked very unwell and very poor, super poor. Had they had some attainment or not, I don't know. They didn't look too well in face at all. So, but none of these, sadhus, sannyasis could explain to him, to Nisargadatta, the answer to the questions he asked. Maruti continued the traditional pujas, ritual worship, fasts, and vratas as per the command of his father. He also went to the Shiva temple at Buleshwar and Walkeshwarand and observed all the necessary fasts as command of his mother. Every day, before going to temple, he'd offer flowers to his mother, make a deep bow, and then go out in search of a cow to feed it with green grass. That's probably some practice. His favorite deity in those days was Panduranga of Pandurpur and the great Saint Dayaneshwar of Alandi. He used to read the Venkateswara Strota. Strota is like a shloka. Everybody spells everything differently. So there's shloka. And Strotra is a Strotra. Strotra is a Strotra, a Shloka? I don't know. Similar to a Sutra, you know. He used to read that Venkateswara Strotra every morning, and while doing so, he stood on one leg by way of penance. Though born in a family eating non-vegetarian food, he gave up eating it and turned out to be a very strict vegetarian. Days went on without any spiritual progress, but finding momentary satisfaction in pujas and vratas. The business was not affected, so this is while his businesses were developing in Bombay. The business was not affected, as very trusted servants were looking after it. He had read stories from Navnath Bhaktisar in his childhood. The incredible ways in which the Navnaths had undergone tapas. Tapas is ascetic practices, and he wrote here arduous spiritual practice. How they had undergone tapas raised doubts in him, but yet he had great respect for Matsendranath. He decided to meet sadhus who knew the ways of tapas. This made him bring home regularly sadhus and sannyasis and offer them bath, puja, and food, and also money, and prostrate before them so that they may show him the way to God. This also did not help him. Then he turned to Hatha Yoga. In Girgaum, there lived a Hatha Yogi by the name of Atavle. Maruti, Nisargadatta, learned this yoga from him and practiced it on the loft of his residence, especially the pranayama and kumbhaka. Kumbhaka is standing on one leg. The practice of kumbhaka swelled his body like a frog, and his hope that this would awaken kundalini and bring him siddhis, magic powers, did not materialize. Then he made up his mind not to go to anybody in search for God and decided that he himself would find him, quote, God, and talk to him himself. This is like, first of all, this biography is akin to the translator, the local translators who wouldn't translate Nisargadatta's cursing. Meanwhile, meaning, as David Godman said, which I believe, and, you know, the people have, in many countries, have a very rigid idea of right and wrong, saint and sinner. So Nisargadatta, clearly a great Jnani and more, according to David Godman, who I don't think is a liar, cursed freely in some times or some phases. Is that a bad thing? Some people would be angry. How dare you say he did that? Why? You presume that's bad? You presume that awakening excludes that behavior? Really? For some, it won't. For some, it will. For some, you know, Nisargadatta and Ramana Maharshi are different fellows. They may be both at the same attainment at the top of the mountain. They got there differently. You think that, you know, anybody who has a problem with David Godman saying that Nisargadatta cursed freely, and many translators didn't translate for fear of offending the sensibilities of the local devotees listening in the room. If you think Godman's lying, I think you're wrong. I think he's not lying. He loves Nisargadatta. Wouldn't lie about him. For what? So, then you have dishonest translators. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. If you love your teacher and your teacher curses freely and you don't translate it because you don't want to offend devotees, you don't love your teacher, or you think you do, but actually you don't know your place. You don't know your place. Most people don't know their place. We have a place, you know, and that's called realism, otherwise called humility. It's called I think I'm around here on the path. There are countless beings above and countless beings below. But I think that's very reasonable. Yeah, there is higher and lower and levels of development in the illusion of seven dimensions and time and space. Yes. And so, know your place. It's not the place of the translator to exclude words from the speaker or their guru, because it may offend some people in the audience. That's how ignorance is perpetrated or maintained, seems to me. So this is a clearly burnished laudatory biography, a little bit hagiography perhaps, making him look like he's this super clean, perfectly saintly, super divine being from day one. Oh, yeah, yeah. Somebody's coming here. Hold a second. An interruption, a glitch in the matrix. Just a moment. All right. A glitch in the matrix, a delivery of a box of herbs for the bathtub. Taiwan culture has many lovely things like Chinese culture, Chinese medicine. So some smart fellows put together an herbal mixture in a kind of tea bag, in a big type tea bag for hot bath. So it's an herbal bath bag of herbs. Anyway, what I'm just saying is this makes him sound like a saint from day one. Maybe he was. Who the hell am I? What do I know? Maybe he was. But I don't like that kind of thing. And so it seems to be in line with David Godman's comment that some of the local translators didn't translate Nisargadatta's free speech where he cursed when he liked. Vulgar speech. And maybe he made sexual jokes. Who knows? And you think that awakening is outside that? Well, not for everybody. I wouldn't hold it against him whatsoever. That's not the same as, like, beating people up, you know. And it's not the same as belittling somebody to devastate their mind, which he could do, I'm sure. So he's not cursing at people. You can say it's harsh speech, but it's certainly not malicious speech. And even if it is harsh speech, is it really, you know, a problem? Is Would one at the summit of the mountain not speak that way? Maybe not. Maybe he's not at the summit. I don't know. Got to figure it out yourself. But you can clearly, I can clearly see that this is a somewhat idealized biography. And, you know, that's fine, but that's dishonest, actually. And so there's a lot of, you know, this is not the planet of honesty. If you came looking for honest souls, you won't find too many here. Meaning people who are really committed to honesty and fairness and reasonability. It's just not normal. They don't care. They don't want it. "You can't handle the truth," said he. And it's true. Most can't and don't want. True. Anyway, so Nisargadatta is trying all these other things, and, you know, there's no shortage of sannyasis, sadhus, self-appointed teachers, or even teachers in lineage who will say, "I can help you. Give me an offering, I can help you. Give me this, I can do this for you." Meanwhile, you know, you can't necessarily attain anything huge after a short time of any practice, of any way. But it was clear to him that he wasn't finding the line, the way of the sadhana path with these teachers and their practices. And the next section is called Meets His Guru, and that's when it's right, it's right. You know, when you meet the one, there's still a path. There's still a lot of work ahead. But there's a sense of I've arrived where I on the right path, on my path. And this is the way I'm going to travel. There's a lot more traveling needed and a lot more sadhana practice needed. But this is the way. This is my way. My sadhana line and teacher in some cases. So, just a moment. So going on, section called Meets His Guru. Maruti Shet, also called Nisargadatta, had a trader friend by the name of Yashvant Rao Bhagkar. He was a highly religious man and often used to discuss bhakti sadhana, devotion. I mean, he has brackets where he translates his words here. Bhakti sadhana, the practice of bhakti. He used to go to a saint in Karnataka, named Shri Satguru Siddharameshwar Maharaj, for his darshan regularly, whenever the guru was staying in Bombay for 2 or 3 months. And so this is, Nisargadatta has a friend, his friend was highly religious, his friend used to go to a saint in Karnataka, and that's who became the guru of Nisargadatta. Sri Siddharameshwar Maharaj was from the famous Nath Sampradaya with Sri Revan Siddha as the original Siddha Purush. Purush is like a being, like Sat Purush is a true being, Mahapurush, Mahapurush is a great being, and Siddha is the head of the lineage, I think. Sri Siddharameshwar Maharaj was a disciple of the famous Sri Bausaheb Maharaj Umadikar Deshpande. Okay. So these lineages. Maruti's friend Bhagkar used to attend regularly the bhajans, the chanting, singing, and the daily discourses. After some time, Sri Bhagkar was blessed with spiritual initiation by the grace of his guru. Again, you see the way people think about these things of seriously honorific perspectives. Naturally, in the discussions with Maruti Shet, Sri Bhagkar told him the gist of the discourses given by the guru. He wanted Maruti Shet, meaning Nisargadatta, to accompany him for the discourse. At this point in time, there was a change in the outlook of Maruti Shet, and he was given the name Nisargadatta. I don't know why. His mind was now ripe, and he'd read about many saints in Maharashtra, like Gajanan Maharaj, Akalkot Swami Maharaj, Gondavalekar Maharaj, and Sri Sai Baba of Shirdi. Sai Baba of Shirdi is the real Sai Baba before the one with the afro. and a very different fellow, and a whole nother story, all of whom preached Prem Bhakti. Prem is love. Prem Bhakti is... See how complicated these systems get. There's Bhakti Sadhana, then there's Prem Bhakti. Is Prem Bhakti different than Bhakti Sadhana? Some would say, and they might even argue. Prem as love, bhakti as devotion, sadhana as practice or discipline. This is where people get caught, or it's very easy for people to get caught in differences in practice, not realizing that they're just ends or means to an end. Nisargadatta, at last we go to that name. Nisargadatta had high regards for them, but in spite of that, there was a lurking disbelief in the existence of such saints in a city like Bombay. Moreover, he was sadly disillusioned when he saw many so-called sadhus and sannyasis who observed it as a way of life for getting their dal roti, daily food. Dal roti is not daily food. Dal and roti means lentil curry and roti bread. See? People, you know, they think they know better than you. And they think that you're a dummy, actually. Many people, many experts think they know better than you and they think you're a dummy. Dal roti doesn't mean daily food. Dal roti means dal and roti. What is dal and roti? Dal is, you know, the traditional lentil curry. There are a million types, but it's a lentil curry. Roti is a bread. So it's lentil curry and bread. Right, okay. And he wrote it, translated in as daily food. Well, it is for daily food, yeah. Dal roti is of daily food, is what they would be eating daily. So, but it doesn't translate dal roti as to daily food. It translates as to dal curry and roti bread. And that's what I mean. It's not a little thing. The telephone game over the centuries, you now have, you know... Tibetan Buddhists worshipping Mahakala, you know, wrathful deity that kills one's enemies. After Gautama spoke nothing of the sort 2,500 years ago. So telephone game ain't fun. It ain't cute, because over the centuries, little distortions amplify. And now you have completely the opposite. You have... you had Japanese Buddhists... having little boy attendance in 300 years ago in Japan for the red string. It's pretty damn far from what happened with Gautama 2,500 years ago. So it's little by little by little, lack of rigorous respect for the original teaching, the original word, the meaning of the original word, without this egotistical, self-aggrandizing modifications, alterations, again and again, little by little, day goes to night. the light turns off. So this is, you know, there's a lot of great stuff on this world and historically and in terms of religious scripture, and it all, in all of it gets perverted. It's all been perverted and distorted over the centuries in every single tradition. So, all right. So, anyway, yes, indeed, Nisargadatta was sadly disillusioned seeing so many sadhus and sannyasis in the robe who observed it, who thought of their life as a way of life for getting their dal roti. Yeah, every day. Food. And also for some money without leading a spiritual life. Yep, that's the majority. He was therefore not interested in taking initiation from Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj or even attending his lectures. So initially, he rejected going to that guru who became his guru. Sri Bhagkar, the friend, trader, felt very sad at this and made a plaintive request to Nisargadatta one day to come and attend the discourses, at least for his sake. Please come at least for me. He agreed reluctantly. Sri Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj was then staying with one of his disciples, Sri Patare, One evening, Nisargadatta and Sri Bhagkar started to attend a bhajan and discourses of Siddha Rameshwar, and I guess that's in Bombay. His brother accompanied them also. They had to go to a place in Tara Temple Lane, where Siddha Rameshwar was staying then, and at the entrance of a lane, they found some young boys making fun of Siddha Rameshwar and laughing loudly and asking people to go back. So you've got that too. One of the most filthy places I ever went were some of the back lanes of Varanasi on the way to the ghats of the Ganges. I mean, like a mass of flies in the air, like 100 flies. You have to walk through a cloud of 100 flies in a smelly alley on the way to the ghat, to the river. It was really intense. I mean, and the government leaves it like that, you know? It has something to do with the government, I would think. Going on, Nisargadatta's brother refused to go further and asked his brother, Nisargadatta, also not to go. But as he had given his word to Bhagkar, he told his brother to go back home if he's not inclined and that he would accompany Bhagkar to the discourse. The discourse that evening was on the Yoga Vaishishta. Yeah. Yoga Vaishishta, which was somewhat difficult to understand and more so to follow, as the type of sadhana preached by Maharaj was beyond his capacity. Right, so he's teaching advanced Advaita Vedanta with Yoga Vaishishta from who? Valmiki or one of the Manus. But the words of Maharaj haunted him and would not leave his mind. After the next 3 or 4 days, Sri Maharaj called him and told Nisargadatta that he wanted to give him initiation. So the guru calls Nisargadatta and says, I want to give you initiation. He had read about guru-shishya relations, where the disciple has to meticulously follow the orders of the guru if he accepted Sri Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj as his guru. Maharaj, you've got a lot of names here. So now we're using Maharaj for Siddha Rameshwar, while before Maharaj was being used for Nisargadatta. So I will try to use Siddha Rameshwar for his guru and Nisargadatta for the main teacher here. So Siddha Rameshwar sensed the difficulty in Nisargadatta's mind and told him, quote, don't worry. If you feel, you see, I'm sure these are not original quotes, but this guy paraphrases and pretends it's a quote. Don't worry. If you feel afterwards that you don't want to continue, you can leave it there. After this, Nisargadatta felt relieved and agreed to become his disciple with a very clear mind and in a happy mood, as it was on his own terms. This again brings into sharp focus his uncompromising nature in his honest search for God. Slowly, the persons who were in business contact with him, or in social or religious life, he dropped away, as they found him somewhat odd. They could not realize that he was always in meditation, having taken Adhyatma seriously. Was he always in meditation? So, I don't know. Was he? Do you know? Does this guy know? Is this guy honest? I don't know. He's putting quotes that don't seem to be quotes. So, anyway, so it's an unusual case where the guru sort of requests a student or seeker to become an initiate disciple, and Nisargadatta was so self-determining and very confident and very peaceful, very self-trusting. I mean, this guy is totally self-trusting, and I really respect that. If he wants to curse, he curses. Oh my God, he cursed. Oh my God, he uses vulgar language. Oh. Again, does that interfere with attainment? I don't know. Well, it is called harsh speech. Okay. And I'm not going to say he's the same as Gautama. I mean, dare we say these things? Dare I say that somebody who's beyond me, apparently, is not of the same level as Gautama and Nityananda? Dare I say that? Well, he dared to say vulgar speech, even though many of the the Hindu translators negated it, I'll dare to say that maybe he's not at the same point as Nisargadatta and Gautama. I don't know. But I don't know. Is it okay to say these things and say I don't know? Some people don't like that. And so, you know, we have a lot of fear in this world. And there's a hell of a lot of judgment. There are a lot of people who are very happy to judge other people. And saying, I don't think that he's at the same level as Nisargadatta, the same level as Nityananda and Gautama. Does that mean I'm bad, that he's something less? Even if he's not at the same level, is he less? Right? Self's a being of infinite worth. Is there some problem even? And so, and should we not say such things? Some people would say, no, you shouldn't. Shut up. And we've lived life in a world like that. We live life in a world where there are a lot of people who are quick to judge and blame and shout at other, especially today. You know? So, there are a lot of people that really should be avoided. And I wouldn't want them in my house. And you should be careful of who you associate with. Don't associate with people who are hateful. And take the rock off your heart. And it's a good thing to speak freely. So, yeah, this looks like harsh speech if he's cursing freely. And I do it too, but I don't claim to be a yoni. I don't claim anything. I just try to be, you know, again, what am I doing? I'm just telling you what I think is good stuff. He's a great teacher and a great being, and it doesn't matter to me that he's cursing, but that doesn't mean I think this is, you know, the same as Gautama and Nityananda. Because there's a lot that just doesn't, it just doesn't happen. In my limited understanding, there's certain things that don't happen when illusion is fully extinguished, when craving and avidya are fully, 100% of it finished. 100% that seven chakra system is ready to go straight to eighth density after death, after parinibbana. There are certain things that just don't happen. And they're fully in accord with the ways of sila and you know, right action, right speech, right livelihood. So, but you know, there is remainder also, and that's a very subtle point, right? There's nibbana with remainder, meaning arahants or fully enlightened beings who are still in a physical body. The remainder is a physical body. Well, could some tendencies of mind be of the remainder, akin to the flesh body retained till the end of the incarnation, after which the entity goes to eighth density? And so certain patterns that look like harsh speech, that doesn't seem a problem to me, but they're harsh speech, be simply of the remainder of the last life? Maybe. I wouldn't know. Could be. So anyway, what's happening is he is going to a higher level of practice and commitment towards liberation. Let me see the time here. 48. Going on. When Maruti prostrated before his guru, the latter, Siddha Rameshwar, asked him to sit in front of him, he heard his guru's words and felt something unusual happening to him, and then went into samadhi. About this unique experience, he told his friends in Marathi, the language, Bambal Zala, which means that his identity changed and he became the whole universe, and in the process, so many colorful lights intermingled. You can see that I see the limits of this reporter. Ultimately, the universal identity also vanished, and he became conscious of his surroundings only when his guru brought him back from this state of samadhi. So, he had a kind of, contact with intelligent infinity, epiphany, awakening, insight, enlightenment experience, kensho, definitely. Identity changed. Now, that may be, breaking the fetter, eighth fetter, right away? Maybe. Became the whole universe. Isn't that fifth and sixth jhana only? Could be. You know, Hindu Vedanta tradition, they're very meticulous, but in certain ways not, like everyone. Certain ways yes, certain ways no. What's the difference between breaking the eighth fetter and the fifth and sixth jhanas of perception of infinity of space, perception of infinity of consciousness? I don't know. One could feel, one could be in the fifth, sixth jhana, formless jhana, in perception of the infinity of space, perception of the infinity of consciousness, and perception of is also the realm of. And so even these words are pretty lousy. An experience of infinite space, which means non-locality, fifth jhana. And an experience of infinite consciousness, meaning non-identity, meaning non-separative identity. So freedom from separative identity, freedom from the belief in localized, in spatial localization. I'm here in this localized space where space is some kind of field, and I am here at this point, not that point. Right? And so fifth jhana, infinity of space, sixth jhana, infinity of consciousness, is basically experiencing the illusory nature of our current experience, familiar, habitual experience of space and identity. Right? Infinity of consciousness means boundless mind awareness. That indeed changes one's identity as an experience of dissolved identity or expanded, boundlessly, incalculably expanded identity. Isn't that an experience of identity changed? Darn right it is. Became the whole universe. That's very much... I'm not saying he had fifth and sixth jhana only. I don't know. But a change of identity is akin to infinity or boundlessness of consciousness, sixth jhana. Become the whole universe is akin to the fifth jhana, infinity of space, meaning non-localized agency. Meaning, I am the agent, the speaker, the doer, the thinker, the guy. I think I'm here, don't I? Don't you think you're here or there? That's agency. Non-localized means not here only, but everywhere. I is here and there and everywhere. Right. That's moving towards omnipresence. It's a taste of omnipresence. Meaning, I is everywhere. Not Scott, the I. The true nature is everywhere. Yeah, of course. Called intelligent infinity. It's called the logos. It's called omnipresence. Yeah, right. Tat sat chit. Sat chit. Tat sat chit is the awareness of tat sat or sat, meaning reality, which is beyond time and space. Or all time and space known as illusion means I is everywhere. The one speaker is totality. Of course. Now, you can have experiences in the fifth and sixth jhana that is not complete and perfect enlightenment, but it's a taste of aspects of the deathless, I would think. So, who can say? So he had Bambal Zala, and he writes, this translator writes, which means his identity had changed, and he became the whole universe. And then this guy writes, in the process, so many colorful lights intermingled. So he has a visual component. Ultimately, the universal identity also vanished, and he became conscious of his surroundings only when his guru brought him back from the state of samadhi. So, identity vanished too, or any sense of boundless I presence ended, and that could be breaking eighth fetter, or infinity of consciousness, I don't know. It goes on, it's not known at this point, at what point of time the name Maruti was changed into Nisargadatta. The surmise of the devotees, right? So this guy got some of this from chatting at the well with the devotees. The surmise of the devotees is that this guru himself had renamed him as Nisargadatta. This guru himself, meaning his own guru, Siddha Rameshwar, renamed him. But anyway, the puzzling questions which troubled him and which nobody could answer were solved at the feet of his great guru. This was in 1933. So he's in his middle 30s. And so that's a great time for awakening. Going on, Nisargadatta was continuing his business and also doing sadhana. He had a feeling that he was being taken away slowly from his family and his relations and friends, and felt a sort of aloofness from everyone. Right, absolutely. A sense of alienation grows with spiritual development or expanded awareness. After the initiation by his guru, his mind changed radically. He gave up all pujas, vratas, and ignored the idols that he was worshipping. So this is the difference between an Advaita Vedanta Jnani, or student and teacher, and those of the Vaita, not Advaita, the dual Vedantic or Hinduist, commonly deistic religious lineages in India. They often, and you see the same with Nisargadatta, Nityananda, where he's basically not encouraging formulaic practice of the different types of sadhana. So, not now, he goes on, now his only god was his guru, and obeyed him without question. Even his brother went away, and only his mother stayed with him till the last, as she was in a position to understand the change wrought on her son. So she was a loving, good mother. That's why she was a good soul and trusted him. But most unfortunately, his wife could not understand him, even though he treated her with respect and, like Ramakrishna Paramahansa, put her on the onward path, meaning he helped her spiritually, but she didn't want it. The teachings of Swami Ramdas greatly appealed to him. See, there was conflict with his wife, but this translator wants to burnish it and keep it all polished so he doesn't talk about it. And maybe, you know, we shouldn't. Dare you. But, she said, how dare you? But, you know, he and his wife had problem. His wife, you know, maybe had big anger. And maybe he wasn't a perfect saintly husband. It's kind of hard to be married, and it's kind of hard to have to be purely virtuous with love, wisdom, perfection before you're fully awakened. I mean, was he fully awakened after that first initiation, expansion, attainment? I don't know. I don't think so. But, you know, this is a burnished biography, well-polished. So his wife couldn't understand him, though he treated her with respect, and like Ramakrishna Paramahansa, he put her on the onward path, meaning he had helped her spiritually develop. Teachings of Swami Ramdas greatly appealed to him. It's well known that Swami Ramdas was a saint of Maharashtra in the 17th century and was the guru of Shivaji Maharaj, another great teacher, I guess. Das Bodh became the Sampradayik Granta of this Siddha Sampradaya and was daily read in the month of Shravana. So this is a Sanskrit-rich text. I can't understand it all, and I don't think it's that important, actually. But there, he's getting involved in, you know, deeper study of saints and the lineage, and throwing away what he feels he doesn't need in terms of the alternate lineages or practices. When rich and learned people used to visit his guru, Nisargadatta used to stand in a corner with a notebook with a pencil and write down whatever fell from the lips of his guru. He used to say that his guru's words were his food, and he used to eat them and not hear them. As the whole of his body turned into Shravan Yantra, and the bhajans, meaning the songs or chanting or devotional singing, were the meals offered to his guru who needed nothing else. On one occasion, when he was alone with his guru, he told him very respectfully that he had doubt in his mind about adhyatma. I think it's, you know, self-realization. I'll get this for you next week. Adhyatma. On one occasion, when he was alone with his guru, he told him very respectfully that he had a doubt in his mind about adhyatma. On hearing this, his guru said, "You will never have a doubt nor get any doubt hereafter." And a doubt and a change came over him, and he found no difficulty in following his guru's words or the teachings in the scriptures. So his doubt was eliminated. Along with other guru bandhus, disciples, pledged disciples, he accompanied his guru to his village Bagewadi in Karnataka on the occasion of the Jayanti of his guru's guru, Bausaheb Maharaj. India's very, religion's very complicated there, okay? For whom his guru had built a samadhi. It's said many gods used to give darshan to Nisargadatta, and he experienced Divya Prakash on many occasions. Surprisingly, when he went to his hometown, he was in a position to give offhand a series of 12 discourses. So he was already teaching from a younger age. For the first time, he surprised everybody who heard them. His guru, Sri Siddharameshwar Maharaj, attained samadhi in 1936. So very soon after he initiated Nisargadatta, just before Deepawali festival, Nisargadatta became very unhappy as he loved his guru very much. He was grief-stricken and used to remember his guru's words, of which he had taken copious notes. Nisargadatta, however, consoled himself and decided to follow his guru's teachings in thought, word, and deed. So, he was a serious student to his guru. He loved his guru, and that's the way great teachers are born. Great teachers were great students who loved learning and loved their teacher or the teachings. You know, the Buddhist path is generally not a guru pad, guru mark, but, you know, we have great respect for Gautama. I do. And know him just as he said he was, a way shower, universal teaching wheel roller, wheel spinner, turn the wheel of the teachings that lead beings to the end of the octave and to the out into beyond, you know, out beyond this all to the next. That's devotional enough, I think. But he was a very sincere student and really loved his guru, and his guru, I think, loved him too. And appreciated him, actually. And probably the guru knew that he was going to pass soon and wanted to transmit the lineage to Nisargadatta. And, you know, found in Nisargadatta the student that he probably was longing for a while, frankly. And for Nisargadatta, he found in his guru just what he was looking for too. And he could dispense with all of the sadhus for hire or the dal roti sadhus at the employment office. And so this is 1936. So by how old was he when he was born, right? Or what? He was zero when he was born. When was he born? Late 1890s, it seems. 1897, 1892, I don't know. So in any case, nearly 40 is the age at which his guru, when his guru dies. And so he's sort of on his own from about age 40, 1936. Interestingly, 1936, Nityananda was, moving from the south to Bombay as well. Pretty heavy concentration. Nisargadatta and Nityananda in the same Maharashtra, in the same west coast of India zone in the 30s, and then 40s as well. serious energy concentration was there. Interesting, actually. And I believe Nisargadatta said something like, "There's not a day that goes by that I don't think of him, Nityananda." So that's anecdotal. I don't know if it's true, but it may be true. And you can see how a great guru comes to be. He's committed to the seeking, and he is willing to sacrifice and lose a lot along the way. He lost a lot of friends, he lost some business opportunity, he lost his wife. He lost all sorts of things. And that's necessary vairagya on the path. It doesn't mean we should push anyone away. But things fall away naturally. Like Ross said, you know, desires fall away naturally. And that's the point. With, you know, continuing to seek the summit, to seek to leap into the boundless, make it your home, or fly into the sun, become one with source, return home to the great home. Slowly, quickly, steep or shallow the ascent, naturally work gets done. The prana circulation continues and the seven chakras develop as they ought to. And then naturally all sorts of tendencies fall away. And naturally all sorts of social relations fall away. And naturally one passes through the sorrow and grief at the loss and moves to a deeper well-being where there's no feeling of loss. And there's not even a feeling of gain. There's just deep equanimity. But I'm not fully there, so it's, again, ahead in the headlights, ahead to be traversed. So anyway, I hope that was useful. I think it's very rich. There is, you know, some polishing in play, which I don't enjoy, but, you know, India is a miraculous, magical place, and so it's kind of not surprising that commonly people exaggerate what is quite amazing to begin with, and then see the amazing and make some exaggerations in general, where indeed amazing, radical, metaphysical realities are still occurring regularly as well. So it's a pretty magical place, the Indian subcontinent, actually. It's very, very high pranic activity. It's just, I just think when I was there a couple of years ago, I really felt people shouldn't live here. This is too high. It's like the whole subcontinent of India is like a temple. It's like a energy vortex, and the rock underneath is serious. The sun, the interplay between the sun and the geology is just seriously solar. It's a very pranic situation. Pranava is loud and clear in India. It's a very high pranic condition, subcontinent, nation. And that's just too much for 3D repeaters, actually, by the way. So in any case, on that strange note, we'll end for today. I hope it was interesting. Next time, we start the continue the bio at the section Leaves for Pandharpur. And it's interesting. It's a rich story of his life, and he's a richly developed guru. So I hope that was useful. Take good care of yourselves. See you next time, and good night.